Hello, and welcome to Media Ministry at Holden Village. Today's date is September 1st, 2004. Today's session number is DEJ 2004-03. Today's speaker is John DeGraff. The lesson for today is choosing time, community time, stewardship time. Let's listen in.
America, today, and the question has come up, you know, some of the things that we looked at were the fact that we Americans work more than people in any other industrial country. We work considerably longer than the Europeans and now even longer than the Japanese, and that this has potentially negative impacts on a whole lot of things, from health to family life, community life, the environment, and other things. And there's been a lot of people have sort of asked, how did we get that way? Why has it always been that way? Why do we in the United States work so much, and why do we feel so urgent and so time-pressed and so frantic compared to other people? So one thing that I actually wanted to do today was do what yesterday we split up into, for a short period of time, into little groups of just two people, and encouraged them to talk to somebody that they didn't really know. And I want to do that again, to have you just find somebody in the crowd that you're not so familiar with, maybe the person next to you, it may not, and talk for we'll go up to nearly 10 minutes, just about why you think why you think we're just so time pressed, and why we work so much as a country, and then we'll talk about that together as a group, and maybe talk about how what kind of places we might intervene to cut that back a bit and to slow down the crazy pace of our lives, which I think many of us agree are doing harm in a lot of ways. So that's what I'd like you to do first, and then we will do that as a group, and we'll be amazed, I think, at how many things come up in terms of how we got in the last 30 years or so from being a fairly normal country in terms of how much we work and in terms of how time-pressed we were. And in terms of a lot of things, including our general health and to a point today where we are definitely the industrial world's workaholics. We're definitely the most stressed and time-pressed people. And our health has really taken a sharp turn down from what it was. Not that we don't live as long as we did then, but compared to every other country, while they've health has gotten better, for us that hasn't been nearly as much of the case. So we've gone basically from being about number 13 in the industrial world in general health, and doctors measure that in terms of longevity, infant mortality, how well young people perform, for instance, on fitness tests, how much chronic illness and hospitalization the country has, and so forth. We've gone from about number 13 to now number 26 or number 27 in the world, below all other industrial countries, and even below two very poor countries, at least somewhat, in one case, somewhat poor country, Costa Rica, and one very poor country, Cuba. So I'd like you just to do that. Find a partner for 10 minutes and just talk about some of the things maybe you might have observed about what seems to be making our lives more frantic, more busy, and more... Okay, Joe's going to write down some of our ideas, and I think you'll be amazed none of these kinds of problems we face have a single cause. There's always multiple kinds of things that interact with other things. The first step, I think, to being able to deal with any social problem, and I think of this as a social problem, although I think most people think of it as a personal problem. I think people, why am I so busy? You know, is it just something wrong with my time management? What have I, I don't know what's wrong with me. I feel like I'm always pressed, I'm stressed, I'm rushed, and so forth. But, you know, when more than half of a population of people, or even when a large minority of the population have the same personal problem, then I think one can think of it as a social problem, as something that has some roots that are not, and one of the things that Dave Bella did, for those of you who were at his sessions, is he kind of has talked about that, about how systems kind of get us in without knowing it and trap us into patterns of behavior that we aren't fully individually responsible for. This doesn't mean that we can't do anything individually or that we don't have any responsibility at all, but that it's larger than just somebody's bad behavior that gets them into this. There are traps, and there are multiple in this case. So let's see what people came up with as some of the things that might be making us feel so busy, stressed, and time pressured. And I know not all of you in this room feel that, but I haven't found too many people, even if they don't feel it themselves, who don't know others who are suffering from this. So who wants to start? Come up with some ideas.
Email and instant messaging.
Okay. Email and messaging. We might put that under kind of these new technologies that are demanding. Yes?
Well, just a constant growing list of things that we need, that people think they need to have to be normal.
Okay. A growing list of what's kind of the standard of living and the expectations of what you have to have. Maybe the whole idea of consumerism, that, you know, our standard of living is based on having more and more stuff. So, yes?
The price of real estate.
The price of real estate, okay. And can you think of some other basic things whose prices have gone up quite sharply in the last
year? Yes.
Energy.
Yes.
Somebody says energy.
Okay.
Yes?
And credit cards.
Okay.
The credit cards made it possible to buy things you basically wouldn't buy if you had any cash.
So expanding credit is one of those things that gets people into. And how does it do that? I mean, you know, you buy things on credit. How does that get you more time pressed?
Well, I think if you're not going out and buy all on credit, and you either feel the pressure when the bills come in, you have to meet your obligation. And that puts the pressure on you to find a second job or more hours and so on. So it really takes time away from your free time.
Okay. Any other these kind of basic things?
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of us have no connection to the idea of a mission in our life, and so we end up frittering time away on a lot of things that don't relate to why we're on Earth.
Okay, how will we look at it? No sense of mission?
With other people, I think we're more, what we want as a family, not reaching out to the neighbors or see what's going on in the neighborhood.
Self-centered, huh?
No sense of priority.
I think the rise of individualism. Right. And the decrease in sense of community.
Okay, and how does that make us more time pressed?
Well, my sense is that, you know, individually, many of us have bought into this idea of we want the biggest house, we want the nicest car, we want the designer clothes, so that somehow people will think of us differently. And that has to do with the consumerism. And then, of course, you have to work harder and longer hours in order to pay for all these things.
Well, the fact that we have to, if we don't have a code or a way of living that we believe in, so we fall into the idea that to justify ourselves, we have to work harder and buy these things. So the fact that to justify your existence through work rather than some other concept.
So, rather than, or through some external thing rather than an internal sense of mission, of purpose, like he was mentioning. Yes, sir.
One of the easiest ways for corporations to improve their bottom line is to cut the amount of staffing, and so that way that those of us that stay in the job just end up having to work longer and longer hours to cover the amount of work that's done.
And faster and faster. Yeah, we call that downsizing, and that is huge, I think, isn't it?
It's like the god of productivity.
And it seems like some of that, at least, is driven by fear that other countries are going to outstrip us or come up with, get ahead of us in some advances of technology or whatever, producing some product or whatever it is. And so we have to win the competition, we have to work harder and longer to do that. And so then it results in what Lynette said.
So global competition has grown in recent years and created that sense that we have to be more efficient in order to be competitive, and to be more efficient means to lay people off and get more productivity out of the people.
Or monitor the ones that are working by how they're using their time and how long they're taking their bathroom breaks or whatever.
Yeah, okay.
I think throwing that more of that people. Competition, that downsizing makes you competitive with your coworkers too. Because if somebody's going to lose a job, is it going to be you or your coworker?
So there's that sense of insecurity, of fear that the individual worker has, that I better put in those extra hours because otherwise I'll be the next one laid off.
You talk about what the unemployment rate is, but the unemployment does not factor in those who are helplessly unemployed to the point where they're not looking for work anymore. Yeah. Unemployment does not figure in the growth in the prison population. Mm-hmm. It doesn't figure in people who are sick and unable to work. And all those three things are increasing. There's more people who are just giving up on looking for work.
That's absolutely true. And how does that
affect? They're stressed out, and that affects us because of our taxes. Our property taxes go up, our sales tax goes up, state tax goes up, federal tax goes up, and the inflation bill, which is a tax, that goes up eventually. So eventually it's all coming back to those who have to work. Instead of four men carrying the table, it's now three men are carrying the table and the fourth man is sitting on the table.
Okay. Yes.
Well, the media, I think, because they fan the fears, they make us work harder to try to control our lives more than we necessarily have to. Like, you see one incident or a crime or an accident that's 1,000 miles away and maybe hardly ever happens, and it's right there in your house, so you think, well, that could happen to my children, so they need this or that, and so you get exaggerated paranoia, which causes you to work harder.
Sure, and what else does the media do?
Well, they put the example of, like, this is how you're supposed to live, so that's the other side of it, too.
Sure, media is the place where we're seeing the barrage of advertising and all those things that says that this is what you have to have a good life. Yes, in fact.
When we talk about downsizing, often the focus is on corporations, but downsizing also is a reality in the non-profit part of our society, in the public part of our society. And when that happens, then if the individual wants to do the work that they feel is appropriate for that job, then the boss simply says, that's all we can do. If you want to work longer hours, you can do it. So that's another situation where, as we were saying before, more and more people are not able to get into that kind of a job because people are forced to work longer hours to produce what is the bare minimum.
It's a really important point that the non-profit sector in our society is is as faced with these kinds of long hours and stress as the profit sector. Yes?
And I think the folks that were mentioned by the gentleman over there who are either underemployed, unemployed, on disability, the systems have become so complex to maneuver through to get your needs met that that creates a kind of pressure as well.
Okay. And of course, we do have people in our society who probably feel like they have too much time on their hands because they don't have the opportunities to have any kind of job at all, things like that. And we hear that, although I think nowadays we more commonly hear from people that they're too busy, that they're working too much rather than that they're not working enough. But certainly with that segment of the population that's unemployed, that's out of that opportunity, then we see the opposite. Yes, Bob?
Yeah, I think we've increased our ability to communicate quickly with like email, messaging, cell phones, and resulting in, you know, people being able to get a hold of us and ask us to do something, we're so available, and we have so many more opportunities to do something, but we end up overbooked, and you know, it's hard to say no. You don't want to miss
always on call.
Yeah,
and so kind of, it's a technological leash because you're always available. I mean, and it's that's the interesting thing that and what some of these technologies are used for. How many people were at the film last night or saw the first part of the film when I actually showed just a tiny clip at the beginning? Because we showed this twice, but there was a little sort of commercial, a very funny commercial actually done by US West, now Quest, the telephone company. And I don't know how many remember this commercial, but it was people were driving up to a driving window, a little driving bank, and they were asking to buy time. And it says, you know, don't you wish that you could buy time? And I said, you know, just give me a minute. I want some quality time. And they said, well, yes, you can buy time. And then the rather key little line that followed that, which I usually no one picks up on, but it may be the most significant line in that whole commercial, is what kind of time does the commercial say you can buy?
Airtime.
Extra what?
Oh, phone time? Is it air time? Telephone hours?
Close. It is telephone, but for what purpose? Extra
minutes? Is it personal?
Not personal.
Business?
Getting, yeah, you're right in the ballpark. Extra working time. So that the whole idea even behind this is you will get these kinds of things not as a labor-saving or time-saving device in the sense that we always thought that all that stuff was supposed to do for us, but in fact actually to give us more time to work and to do all the things that have us so busy in the first place. Yes?
My son was a troubleshooter for the telephone company. Every time the phone rang, it was trouble someplace. And they had 11 members in his unit, and they decided they only needed 3 of them. And they laid 8 of them off and expected the 3 to do what was left. And Dale said, because we had it all running smoothly, the 11 of us did. But when everything starts going to boogie, how are 3 of us going to take care of it? Oh, his job was stressful. It was terrible.
Increasingly the case for many, many people. There's one item that we talked about increased, oh, we did mention medical care.
I added that.
You added that, yeah. Okay.
When we got into increased.
Yeah, the cost of health is probably, of health care, probably the most rapidly rising cost. You know, interestingly enough, the price of energy has not increased nearly as much as people think it has. It did quite suddenly in the last year, so we feel that way. But when we actually look in terms of comparison to even to the 1950s and we look at the rate of inflation, it hasn't gone up that much.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is related. I heard a report today on public radio that's coming out. It came in today, and they were talking about how CAT scans have been linked to cancer now, and then they played a commercial where they're saying they they, in the commercial, they show a bunch of, they were talking about it, they showed a bunch of, like, coffins, and they say, well, if you don't get a CAT scan, this is where you're going to end up, so. And that kind of pressures, like, you know, you put the fear of your health, the two together, like those Michelin tires, I think, that had the baby in it, said there's a lot riding on your tires and things.
Yeah, and the sense of creating insecurity in order to get you you into that. What's another thing that's really gone up for many, many people in price? Think in terms of your kids, for example, and their future.
Education,
particularly at the
college.
Post-secondary level, I mean, beyond high school.
John, do we need a second call for anything else, or shall I start?
You can go right ahead.
Good.
Yeah. I remember, and just to kind of show how old I am here, I remember that it was basically 40 years ago this fall that I entered college at the University of California. And you could go to the University of California at Berkeley in those days, probably one of the very leading public institutions in the United States, and you could go there for $126 a semester. That was the total cost. There really was no tuition. That was the price of certain fees, which included health care for your student health package for everybody, $126.
What's Berkeley
and
now?
This was very, what's Berkeley now? About $13,000. So, you know, a huge difference for people. This was in state. If you were out of state, you were paying a few thousand dollars even then to go to Berkeley. But for in-state students, and for many of our public institutions, this was the case. So, let's see. What are other things that keep us really, really
busy? One of the things related to the ability of corporations to downsize and the whole fear of competition in their jobs is the whole legal system that looks at corporations as an individual and the rights that are given to corporations above and beyond what individual people have, so that they have more power than what individuals have.
I would agree with that, but that's been the case for, you know.
Right. I wouldn't, when you said 30 years, that's been going on for over a century now in the U.S.
Yeah, right. And it certainly does give them powers to do many of these kind of things, but they've had that for a long time, and there are many of these things that have come up that are more recent. What about the hours that places are open? What do you remember from even a generation ago? I mean, does anybody remember when 7-Eleven started? And 7-Eleven was pretty unique. In fact, what did the terms, what was 7-Eleven? What did it mean?
7-Eleven.
It opened at 7 in the morning and closed at 11 at night.
And that meant it was open long.
And that was considered staggering. To have hours that long, you would name a place after that. I mean, would mean absolutely nothing today, because so much of everything is open 24 hours. I'm sure many of you remember when the majority of businesses were not open on Sunday. So what happens when everything is open 24 and everything is available 24/7? Now there's I'm sure many people will look at and say, well, there's a positive side to that. I can get things anytime that I need them. And so for the consumer, I think that can be seen as a plus. But how does that affect time for people? Yeah.
Well, it seems to support an urgency addiction where you never do any planning about when or where or where it, or think put in advance planning about when or where you'll get the paper plates or the plastic cups or whatever. You just send somebody to the store at 4 in the morning and you're ready for breakfast.
For one thing.
Yeah.
For one thing, right. And, of course, somebody has to be there.
Right.
So So it means that many more people are working on the weekends, that they're working at night, all of those kind of things.
I got one to add. Computerization.
Mm-hmm. And how does...
Well, just because the systems keep changing so fast that there's a pressure to put in the time to upgrade and keep ahead of the system.
Yeah.
Or learn the complexity of a sometimes very complex system.
What's the lifespan of the average computer considered to be nowadays? Does anybody know?
3 years. It's
absolutely
as soon as you buy it.
Well, most people would say that it's about halfway between what you're saying and what you're saying. The figure normally given now is about 18 months. It's the typical kind of lifespan of a normal computer until the fact that you, although the computer may be perfectly good, but you have a sense that it's just not fast enough because we've already had another order of magnitude of speed in that period of time, so it just doesn't work anymore, and it seems so slow and laborious to have this thing that 18 months ago seemed so fast.
That's right.
And it kind of affects our patience.
There's court records that indicate that people used to talk much more slowly. They couldn't figure out how much was said and how much time, and it used to take a lot more time. It's like take a lot more time. I mean, it's just you can keep up with the computers, and it wasn't really like in another 50 years. How fast are you talking?
Well, you have shorthand, for expressing yourself. I mean, to some degree, we do. Yes.
Another idea is the importance of sport activities and how this impacts families. The necessary games and practices and cuts into
organized competitive sports.
Okay, organized competitive sport. Is it just sports?
No,
activities.
Yeah, there's countless options, and some of them, particularly when they're sports and when you have when you don't have the facilities, you may not have the parks. In the case of a big one, for instance, you take a place like Minnesota where hockey is a huge sport for young kids now, where people tell me that they sometimes have to book, the kids go to have rink time, they can get ice time at 4 a.m. because this is the thing, everybody is doing this, there's this sense that you have to do it, and yet it's, you need to do it in a very specific kind of place. It's not just going out there and playing on the lake.
Uh-huh. Well, it's almost like with the scheduled activities, there's a kind of a keeping up with the Joneses sort of thing. If our kid is to be smart and get into, say, Berkeley, then we need to get her in sports and music lessons and all these other things. I actually heard about I can't remember if it was Pennsylvania, but there was a principal who was making some headlines because he was convincing, he convinced his school to change this, and then a couple other schools to take away nap time from the kindergarten because it was a waste of time. I mean, they're just...
The city of Atlanta, and it was just the first, and there have been others, has simply eliminated recess for primary schools.
Well, you're just running around.
Yeah, because they want them to have all, to be learning and doing something all the time. And of course, now it starts really early. You can get something so that your kid learns while they're in the womb. People feel like, and there's a lot of pressure that says, you have to have little Einstein and whatever these kinds of things are called. So, and if you don't have it, somebody else's kid's going to learn in the womb and get ahead of your kids. So it's very...
And the irony is the parents that are doing this to their kids often had a ton of time when they were kids just to play around with whatever they wanted.
They did. But there's, the fear is out there because of this, as someone mentioned, this whole competitive sort of situation. And are they going to, what does it take now to land that job and to hold that job? Now there's a backlog. I mean, we're starting to see some response to this, and I think there's some it's very positive, and some of you may be familiar with some of these initiatives that are starting about the overscheduling of kids and families. The first one is called Ready, Set, Relax. Has anybody heard of this? It's an initiative that started in Ridgewood, New Jersey, which the town just decided that one Wednesday night each quarter, I mean every 3 months essentially, nobody would schedule anything. There would be no game scheduled, there would be no practices scheduled, there would be nothing scheduled, it would just be time to spend with your family. It's a fairly simple little thing, but it got huge attention because it was so unusual. We have now, particularly in the Twin Cities, there are a lot of family organizations getting started that are trying to deal with this kind of what they call take back your kids, putting family first. But they're saying, you know, we don't want the kids to be totally scheduled up. And they're getting some support from interesting places. A couple of years ago, Harvard University actually sent out a letter to the parents of all prospective entering students. And the letter said, enough already. It said, you know, stop overscheduling the kids who are coming here because your kids have done so many things by the time they get to Harvard, they are burned out. And we don't want them like that, you know. We want kids who still have an eagerness to learn, to do other kinds of things and stuff. So try cutting back on some of these activities. We'll still let your kid in, you know, so. Mm-hmm.
Well, speaking of scheduling, I find it really interesting. I left my planner at home, and I stood in front of the kiosk out here, and I looked at Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and I thought, this looks just like my planner. I'd like to go to all the things that are listed there.
Preach it. Mm-hmm. Just listen for the bell.
But there's no. But you don't need to.
Right.
And that's the nice thing
but
here.
But my planner at home, I don't need to either because I'm retired.
Yeah. You kind of feel. So that's a part of it too, where you get kind of caught up in all of this. We talked about the medical care thing, and how does that, it's not just the cost of it, but how does that affect some people in terms of work and time and can anybody, you know,
keep working a particular job because they're afraid they can't get private insurance.
Mm-hmm. Because for many people, the job is the most important single thing about the job is the access to the health care. Mm-hmm. And I've talked to doctors, plenty of them, who actually say that they have this strange phenomenon that they get patients who come in and the patients are just frazzled. And, you know, they've got all kinds of things from gastrointestinal problems to potential cardiac problems and all these things. And the doctor says, you really have to, you're working too much. And, it's sort of killing you. I mean, you've got to find some way to cut back and reduce the hours and do that and so forth. And the response from the patient is, but doc, if I do that, then if I cut back, I mean, my employer won't allow me to cut back. That's part of the job. If you know, it's take it or leave it, and then I'll lose my health insurance and I won't be able to see you. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of catch 22. This is the case for many, many people, and it makes our country quite unique. I mean, because it really isn't the case anywhere else in the industrial world. It's a completely American thing, and it's, how many people, does anybody here know why we do healthcare the way we do healthcare in the United States? That is why employers pay insurance companies for our healthcare, or we pay insurance companies to cover us for our healthcare.
Is that sort of the natural order of things? How did that come about?
Individualism, that, the independence, American.
Seems overdetermined.
Lobbies.
And what do you mean by that?
It seems like there's probably more than just one simple answer to that, doesn't it?
No, there's actually one fairly simple answer.
Wow. One problem businesses often have is holding on to their employees. If they have health insurance, it's one more thing they can hold on to their employees with.
You're getting right to the point. So when did this happen? When did this model start in the United States?
The unions. Did the unions ask for health care as a benefit for the employees?
They certainly do today and have... initially did. But does anybody know when we first started doing healthcare this way in the U.S.?
In the last 20 years?
Oh, no.
FDR.
World War II. So what was going on during World War II?
Some people are entering the workforce.
There, we had a shortage of people in the workforce.
The men were gone and the women were...
Mm-hmm. And what else did we have?
Military economy.
We had a strong central government.
Yeah, but and what did that strong central government impose that it doesn't?
Social security.
Wage control.
Rationing.
Do we have rations?
We did. Rationing was one, but that's not the one I'm thinking of.
You're
going to
have to just tell us.
We had what were called wage and price controls.
Wow.
And the effect of wage and price controls and a shortage of labor was that businesses who wanted to get workers could not offer them higher wages. So they had to offer them something else instead. And the thing they did to attract people, and the thing also that unions who were there who couldn't get for their employees who were becoming more productive and working harder, higher wages, what they asked for was health benefits generally, but most importantly health benefits. And so that as that came about, it created with it a whole industry, the insurance industry, that then really became a force to keep things that way. Because once for somebody it's their whole livelihood, their profitability to have the system a particular way, then they don't like any kind of change. Now that wasn't the way healthcare developed in other countries. They didn't have quite the same sorts of systems. So they, for most other countries, either before or right after the war, they developed national healthcare systems that were funded primarily through the tax system and were what we call single-payer systems. They were also in part sometimes funded by employers, but never completely by the employer. And they covered everybody and still do cover everybody. So the health thing is a big one. A lot of people want to hold on to that. It's a big one in terms of cost. A feeling like, boy, I'd better earn what I can earn now and stuff, because my gosh, those medical bills, who knows what's going to happen when they hit. And of course, health for many people has been a big source of debt, and debt itself gets us into that. One other thing that I want to mention, what's happened to our sort of spatial life, I mean, the way we live in terms of space these days in the last generation
sprawl.
Or two?
Urban
more
sprawl.
Space.
What's it called?
Two houses.
Sprawl. Mm-hmm. And well, how does sprawl affect time?
Takes time to commute.
Transportation becomes a bigger factor. And a big factor both in terms of cost and a factor in terms of time, so that we are now, you know, our commute times are about double. And it pushes us, of course, to a particular mode of transportation, because the automobile For all its faults, for most people, it's still a quicker way to get around, and particularly in many situations where sprawl exists, there isn't very much public transportation. So, but one other thing I just want to get to, because it hasn't been mentioned yet, that is, I think, a big cause, particularly of our overworking in America by comparison to other countries, and that is the growing inequality in the United States. And it's sort of an irony, but as the gap between rich and poor grows, and it has grown sizably by back in 1970, for example, there was a gap. There's always been a major gap. So in 1970, the top 20% of the population in the United States was earning somewhere around 9 times as much as the bottom 20%. Now that's a pretty sizable gap. But if you look at just the report that just came out a couple of weeks ago, it was in both, I live in Seattle, and it was on the front page of both Seattle papers, Rich Get Richer, Poor Get Poorer. It showed that gap is now about 15-1. Now the interesting thing is that growing inequality it puts pressure, work pressure and time pressure on people at every level. And that doesn't seem necessarily logical, but why might that be the case? Why would people who are in the top income brackets, who, you know, are earning enough, and so why would they actually be working more, choosing in many cases to work more than they did a generation ago?
They still want more.
Fear of losing what you have, also wanting more, having all this. You know, we've had enormous increases in the purchase of various kinds of luxury goods. I mean, some of the fastest rising types of cars in terms of sales and things are at the highest levels. But what else do people think that they can do if they work really hard now and they make a lot of money?
Retire
early. So one of the things that actually drives this is the sense that if I work really, really hard now, I can pile up a lot of money and I can retire early. And what else can I do with the money?
Give it to your kids.
Invest it.
Well, be with your kids, but that's harder if you're...
No, he said pass the money on.
Oh, pass it on, okay. And invest it. Most importantly, invest it to make even more. Because what we're seeing is this is the place where the real money is to be made at this point. The stock market, for instance, has grown at a rate far more rapid than the rate of the normal economy and the gains that people make in wages and things like that, for example. So if you can invest, you've got higher opportunities. You can buy real estate, various kinds of things that you may buy. So what we've seen is that people who make more, and how has that, why do you think the gap has, what is it that we've done since the mid-1970s that may account for the growing gap between rich and poor? Because I think this is very key. I mean, what have we done?
On both ends of the spectrum, there's things we've done. We've done some stuff to encourage people to get rich. We've done stuff to encourage people to get poor.
Right. And what are some of those things?
To encourage them to be poor?
Yeah.
Okay. Let me see. Encourage them to be poor. Let's see. I used to have a neighbor. He knew more about that game than I know about my career. He knew more about how to beat the system and how to exploit it, how to take advantage of all the entitlements, all the free stuff out there. He was really good at that. he wasn't pretty healthy. He died a few years ago. On the other hand, the other end of the spectrum, there's a lot of status where people can be wealthy, and advertising, TV, get a nicer car, and probably the status is what encourages people to get wealthy. They'll say, well, tax them when that doesn't matter. They'll still keep on earning and earning and earning. But I think very often the education, it encourages, that the education has gone downhill over the years, and you have the National Education Association, at least in the state where I'm from, they're opposed to a lot of reforms that are necessary to improve education, and who gets hit by that the worst is the poor people. They get out of high school and they like talk like this and that, and who's gonna have, they can't find a job anywhere because they don't even know how to talk right, and they can hardly, a lot of teachers can hardly read and write. And that's a major incentive for people at the low end of the spectrum. Well, that's an involuntary incentive for them to stay poor, because you know, they just can't. And they're discouraged because they know that no matter how hard they try, there's always going to be that other person who went to a private school who can just do the job a little bit better than they can. That's where the job's going to go. So they're just going through their young years helpless, knowing that no matter how hard they try in the school, they're not going to do well. And some schools have just given up on the students, just like a babysitting institution to watch the kids and have trouble.
Okay. And so we've had, has anybody followed what's happened, for example, generally with our tax system?
There's incentives for rich people to invest their money, not always in socially beneficial ways, or in this country necessarily. And there's, you know, if you have a kid, by the end of the year you can get a break, get another break.
A lot of tax shelters aren't there for the rich.
That's right.
Yeah, I mean, but if you look, for instance, at how the society got its taxes in the Eisenhower administration, for example, or in the Kennedy administration, changed somewhat in the Kennedy administration, more to the direction it is today, but not the same way. As recently as 1960, the highest marginal income tax rate in the United States, that means the highest rate that anybody could pay, depending on how much income they made. Does anybody know what that was?
98%.
How much?
28%.
No, it's higher.
No, 90?
90.
Yeah.
90%. Now, I'm not saying that that's a good thing, and there were a lot of problems with that, and there was some necessity to pull that back a little bit, because there was clear that there were other kinds of problems that caused. What's the top one today, the top bracket today?
39.6.
That was 28.
For ordinary income, it's
for income alone, it's now about 33. But few people are paying more than about 28. But people at the top level normally, plus, you know, there are many loopholes. And another thing is another source of about half of, for instance, our revenue in the United States as recently as 1960 came from the corporate income tax.
Yeah, that's one.
Now we get about 6% of our overall income. So, and now, where are most people, average people, paying most of their taxes these days? What part of the tax burden is highest? Do you think about that?
I mean, these are fees. Like, you get double tax. Like, you pay your tax, and then you get taxed again when you go out camping, or whatever. So the middle class gets double taxed.
You get all those fees.
Yeah,
but a lot of things that used to be free are now, they now hit you for those. But most middle class people today are paying more money in their payroll taxes.
Social Security
and things like that than they are in their income taxes. That's a big change.
Can you really call that a tax, though?
Yeah.
I mean, it's tax incentive that's required, but it's like a required investment almost, because you're getting that back someday.
No, it's a pay-as-you-go. Yeah, you are, in a sense, that's true, but it's definitely a tax that hits harder at people at the lower levels, because if, for instance, you look at Social Security, you only pay into that system percentage up until, I don't know what the figure is now, I think the last thing I saw was at about 87,000. That's the maximum that you pay in, whereas in income tax continues to go up. So these kinds of taxes, sales taxes, payroll taxes, property taxes, other kinds of things which tend to hit people at the bottom harder, have actually become a much bigger part of our overall tax burden for all of us. Income tax, and then capital gains taxes, which have been virtually eliminated. And then now the estate tax, which is another one that really only about 1% of the population pays. It's been called the death tax, but virtually nobody except nobody earning under a few million dollars a year pays it. But as we eliminate those kind of things, the tax burden is shifted, then the gap becomes bigger. And then we see that the people at the top who pay less actually have an incentive to work more, because they keep a bigger share. I mean, it used to be that you might think about it and say, well, if they're going to tax as much as they were going to tax anyway, why work all these extra hours and so forth? But now it makes sense to do that. And then what about people in the middle? Why would this affect their working more?
People at the top don't necessarily just invest their money in the corporations. They'll invest in the same thing that I might be interested in that there are some goods that we actually have bidding wars for, and all of us bidding on a house see that all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have the extra money, they'll pay more money for the same thing that I might want. And suddenly I find myself not being able to afford the
Right. Yeah, real estate prices, and particularly in certain areas. And again, a lot of this kind of does depend on where you live. And
but it depends on if there's a lot of wealthy people around where you live.
Yeah.
And we see all these little pockets of population being corrupted by great wealth.
Uh huh. It's absolutely true. I mean, if you're in an area where most people are much more middle class, then the prices will be more affordable to you than if you're living in an area where you are middle class, but other people have more. And there are other factors about. I mean, this is kind of complicated stuff. But what's happened then too for people in the middle is that they feel like if the only way to keep up with the Joneses, so to speak, is you can still do it, you can still get some of the kinds of things, but you do it by having more people in the family working, by people working more or longer hours, and often by debt, by going into debt, by charging things, and then that gets you further into this kind of trap. And then the people on the bottom have seen their real incomes actually erode. I mean, the very poor in this country actually earn less in real terms today than they did, back in 1970. And so for them, often there's this push to work 2-3 jobs just to make ends meet. So everybody kind of gets hit by it. I'm trying to, this is kind of going on along. I think we're supposed to come to it.
Are you going to give us a solution other than immigrating? Because I was actually going to say, I watched that movie with the family with chickens and I live that way, but I'm also a tax attorney. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to simplify my life, but I have to earn a living. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if single people without I have the luxury of having a spouse I can share the family expenses with. Mm-hmm. And I don't think a single person, you know, whatever you call a single wage earner family, could really do all that chickens and garden stuff.
Yeah.
And
well, I'm not necessarily suggesting that. I mean, tomorrow we're going to talk about some of these kinds of, you know, the specifics. We have, well, I'm, as I've told people before, I'm the national coordinator of a campaign called Take Back Your Time. And it's been going on for a couple of years. And I'm going to talk tomorrow evening, for those of you who come, about what that campaign is all about and what we're encouraging people to do at all kinds of levels to win back some time for themselves. But as you can see, this is sort of a huge subject that even trying to get at the bottom of what the causes are for this. And I can assure you there are many, many causes and many, many factors that go into this rat race that we haven't even talked about yet today. But the question then becomes, if we want to change this, how in the world and where in the world do you start? Where do you intervene? You know, this is this massive, massive problem. And that's what I'd like to, you know, I'll try to talk about some tomorrow.